when you're ready, let's start this game.
Welcome to Unstacked and Let's Unwind with fantasy author Ed McDonald. Let's find out about his writing process and the second book of the Red Winter Chronicles, Traitor of Red Winter. Hey, this is Sarah from the Bay County Public Library.
Hey, this is Stephen from the Huntsville-Madison County Public Library.
Hi, I'm Ed McDonald. I'm the author of the Raven's Mark trilogy and the Red Winter Chronicles.
Can you introduce our listeners to the Red Winter Chronicles? I know that you love giving the elevator pitch, but just a little bit of an introduction to Daughter of Red Winter and Traitor of Red Winter.
So the Red Winter Chronicles they're kind of the book baby that sat in my mind for too many years, an amalgamation of all the ideas that I had as a teenager and in my 20s that I eventually wrote into a monster novel. It was enormous and no one wanted to publish it. And then I rewrote it completely from scratch. So Red Winter Chronicles are based very, very vaguely in Scottish folklore and mythology. It's an epic fantasy series about a young protagonist, Rain, who she is cursed with being able to see the spirits of the dead in a society which reviles that and will kill her for it. At the same time, she's kind of becoming, the Queen of Darkness. So not everything goes well for her.
And I enjoyed Daughter of Red Winter so much that I didn't take a break from book one to book two. I just had to go right into the next one, which for me, that speaks volumes because I don't even do well with long books. And these are long titles, but I was like, I need more. And your storytelling is just so fantastic. So do you have any personal rules on how to keep your readers captured in an epic fantasy?
I sort of do and don't. For a first chapter, I have rules like no more than three named characters, no more than one named place. Something has to happen which is not resolved. That's just first chapter. But this is less rules, perhaps, and more things that I've learned work for writers as I've written and critiqued over the years. For the whole story, I do it very. There are certain story beats which get hit as you go on throughout it. And people codify that into things like the hero's journey or the three-act narrative structure. That's it. I've never any theory or anything like that. I've just seen people talking about them. But it feels very natural that you hit these beats. My structure goes, inciting incident, investigation into what it is. Oh, no, it's not what we thought, and it's worse. Make a plan to try and stop it. Attempt to stop it. It goes even worse than you thought. And if anything, the plan makes it worse. Terrible moment. Everything's gone awful. Everyone despairs. Someone has died. and then make a new plan. Enact plan. Learn something about yourself that enables you to resolve it. Because especially in fantasy, I believe in fantasy books, the magic, whatever the mystical element is, ought to both drive the story and resolve the story and be the cause of the main character's principal character development arc. There's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes sense.
My books are very much character narratives. They're character studies, if anything. There are big, epic, overarching plot lines in Red Winter. There's war, and there's political conspiracy, intrigue, cults. But really, much more than that, it's the story of a teenage girl suffering trauma, trying to find who she is, how she can fit into a world in which, much like our own world, the world doesn't really want people like her to succeed. It wants her to know her place, to, bow down, not be special, and to do what the men of the world want her to do, essentially. And when you can tear people's souls out, that's probably not going to happen.
So kind of branching off of that, this is obviously a fantasy book. So what goes into the world building and the magic building of these kind of novels?
Well, I used to give an answer that I just make it up as I go along, but that's not true with this, because this evolved out of an older idea. The Red Winter magic system is an existentialist magic system. I've always been fascinated by the idea that there are things and there is nothing. There is matter and there is vacuum. But within matter, there is also vacuum, because between atoms, there has to be nothing. but it's still connected and things can still move through it. And so the idea of what is the difference between my atoms and your atoms? Why is that distance of vacuum important? Like, why are we not the same thing? Or why is everything not one? Or is it one? Is our consciousness just a trick playing in our own minds? So that's the basis for the Red Winter Magic System. If you can expand your consciousness out of your own molecules into other people's molecules, into other things, then why can't you move them like you can move your arm? Coming up with seven spheres of reality. They serve the plot, though. It's really important to stress that I don't create magic for the sake of... I want some lights and laser beams. there's no laser beams. But I want the cool, flashy stuff. But it's all to do with how does this tell a story? And in particular, Rain's powers are undeath and necromancy in particular. So she starts with seeing the dead, and by traitor, she's very much moved into the arena of being able to manipulate and draw on the dead for various things. And there's certainly a reflection into her personality and what that means. That's very much intentional, and all of the magical elements are about telling that girl's story in these books. And so the trauma she suffers in book one, the mental scarring that she goes through in book one, is a direct mirror to the magical work.
And then Traitor of Red Winter is much more based in politics. So there's power and rule is much more heavier. The book one is very much building on Rain. It's fascinating how much political intrigue can move a plot line, alliances, and deciding who you can trust. I kept guessing who the traitor was from the beginning. I was wrong. How do you map out your approach to plotting politics in a fantasy novel?
Oh, mapping out politics. So unfortunately, it's the same answer. It's they serve whatever those story beats I was talking about. What are the story beats and how do I make them happen? So I actually wrote 90,000 words of this book before I realized I didn't have a bad guy. I didn't have an antagonist. I'd just kind of been writing a soap opera, which is weird for part two. But I was so enjoying writing about the young people and who they kissed and who they're planning to kiss. Because, you know, these are teenage characters. And yes, there's a big political backdrop, but their everyday concerns are more like being jealous that the person they fancied kissed someone else 3 years ago. So the question is, how do I use political figures to serve the plot? So in Red Winter, there in Traitor of Red Winter, there's this north-south divide, which is obviously very reminiscent of a sort of Scottish English, the English occupation of Scotland in the past. And I was doing an event in Scotland at a wonderful bookstore, and the interviewer said, aren't the bad guys right? Aren't the rebels right about their political demands? And I said, yeah, they absolutely are right. And they're supposed to be right. We're not on the right side all the time. Our protagonist doesn't get to choose whose side she's on. And yeah, I have great... I mean, the rebels are also, like, they're not good people. Their ends don't necessarily justify their means. And it's the way they do it, or the way they hurt people, that makes them the villains. But equally, without giving spoilers, we you know, it's called Traitor of Red Winter. There are villains on all sides. So yeah, the politics, it's letting me tell stories about young people learning who they want to kiss and becoming necromancer witch queens.
So you kind of talked about it a little bit here about how this, it has some flavor of the tensions between Scotland and England. You've talked about how the characters don't always get what they want, much like the real world. How much real world experience influences your writing?
Ooh, I've never been a teenage girl, and I've not had to deal with a lot of the things that that Rain has to deal with. So I trained for a good number of years in historical European martial arts. So swordsmanship, fighting with axes, things like that. Using historical texts that teach you how to do the actual sword fighting. So I did that. So when it comes to those parts, there's sort of some lived research. I have degrees in medieval and ancient history and archaeology, but To be honest, I don't really do research. If I wanted to do research, I write historical novels. Part of the reason that I like writing fantasy is when something doesn't fit what you want it to for the narrative, you can just change it, you can make it up, or do whatever you need to in order to get things working. So I do think, though, that like I think the books I write are more deeply invested in emotion than anything else. It's an emotional journey. And when I look back on them, I can see what I was feeling at the time over maybe a year has hugely impacted the books. So in previous books I've written, I've gone, oh, you know, that's what was going on in my life at that time. There's a lot of philosophy and narratives about, you know, the end of things, you know, or something like that. So some authors are lucky. Some authors don't need to put themselves into the page. I don't intend to. I just can't really help it.
So kind of talking about that studying of historical martial arts, the combat scenes tend to be very brutal and short, as opposed to these long kind of drawn out of parry thrust, you know, is that based on that kind of training or?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's if you've ever tried to sort of do any martial arts or combat sports or anything, I think perhaps we get a wrong idea from things like boxing, which you know, is intended and designed to last as sort of as long as possible in order for it to be spectatable. If you watch someone doing historical European martial arts in a sort of competitive setting, people will pad themselves to the nines and do this. It's like if they play to a point, which is silly in something where you don't have points. And I've competed in these as well. It is over in under 3 or 4 seconds, almost every time. It's very, very rare that a fight between two people who want to actually hurt each other lasts more than 30 seconds. Part of the reason for that is after 30 seconds, whatever you're doing, you're absolutely exhausted if you're in a fighting situation. It's killingly difficult to maintain any kind of intensity for a prolonged burst of time. The boxers and people like that who do it, they're professionals. They train every day. Like they have to condition themselves to be able to endure this like mass energy requirement. And of course, if you hit someone with something sharp and heavy, then things don't need to go on for a long time. There's also the narrative reason that I think short and punchy is exciting. And, you know, I know some people really enjoy long, very long, you know, multi-chapter sword fights. That, for me, I find it hard to keep up the tension and keep up the stakes during that. So, yeah, want to move them on.
We've got I haven't been to them yet, but they're on my bucket list things. Right up north of us in Nashville, they have what they call medieval cage fighting. So it's kind of set like an MMA kind of style thing, but the people go in full armor, but it turns into, you know, they start with weapons, but it doesn't last that long. And next thing you know, you got people bashing each other in the head with shields and just full on trying to make that spectator, but still.
Well, I've seen these guys doing this. I think they're nuts. you've basically got a situation where you've got people wearing armor intended to stop weapons of this type, which it's very good at. Then they have to use weapons that are safe for doing this with, except everyone gets broken bones and everyone gets hurt because you just can't be safe from a guy whacking you with a crowbar. Like, it doesn't matter what you're wearing. Eventually, you're going to get a broken hand or a broken neck. I mean, good on them for doing what they enjoy. I mean, and, you know, these are the guys wearing the full, the most protection they can afford. Mm-hmm. And with all our modern technology, the best we've come up with is medieval armor.
It's just one of those things where everybody wants to see that train wreck of violence.
Well, we all like watching violence when we know there's going to be a happy outcome, don't we? I know my books are, you know, there's a lot of violence in them. I'm actually, like, for a person who's like done martial arts in my life, I've never thrown a punch at anyone in my life. Never. I don't know what it's like outside of sporting type stuff. I have no idea what it would feel like to punch someone. I don't want to know. I think, you know, I enjoy necromancy in my books. I'm not sure I don't know how close I want to get to it in the real world.
And your books do feel like that medieval Scottish Highlands, but with magic. And you mentioned before that you studied ancient and medieval history. Was there any nods to, because there was even the two characters, Sandbot and Liara, they both do theater. Was there a little bit of a nod to maybe Shakespeare in that? Since it's kind of, I don't know, I could be making that up.
Yeah, there probably is a little bit. I was very much, when they do their show, I was very much envisaging a theater much like Shakespeare's Globe. And I really love the idea of what theater would have been like back in those days, where, like, it's the live TV, isn't it? No one goes to theater these days. If you say to someone, oh, should we go to the theater? They look at me like I'm crazy. But, you know, Shakespeare's, his theater, you had stalls of people standing. And as far as I'm aware, you know, you'd have people going through like popcorn sellers selling you, you know, rat on a stick or whatever the room. But it would be noisy. It'd be, you know, it's a little bit, you know, the characters in Shakespeare's plays very much speak to the audience all the time. They're always addressing them. And if you imagine like a rowdy talking audience who, not everyone's paying attention. Some people are just there for the beer, you know. It's a very different experience to what we, you know, if you're in a theatre these days and you whisper something, you get angry looks going around. So we've changed the medium. But yes, I think as well, my sister's a musical theatre writer. And, you know, like the teen dramas you get amongst the theatre kids are amongst the most impressive of all teen dramas. So, yeah, it felt quite... It felt very natural. I needed my, you know, my teenage characters to have some interests and things to do which weren't about politics and magic and war, because they have to like things. And you have to be able to describe your characters in terms of what would they be doing if the plot wasn't happening, if there were no bad guys. What would your... And one of my favorite exercises I give writing students for this is imagine that your character lived today in our world. What job do they have? What do they do on the weekend? Because they should have a personality that exists outside what the plot needs them to do and the conditions of the world being imposed upon them. Yeah, what do? They put on a bad theater play.
It was fun to see them, you know, just being creative and apart from everything else. And there are fae and hidden folk, undead demons, the supernatural, and my favorite is the moon horses. And while I've heard of like hidden folk, I've never heard of moon horses until now. I'd love to meet one, even though I don't know whether that would be good or bad. How does folklore just overall inspire your writing process?
It comes down to feeling. There is a real feel to the Gaelic mythology and Celtic mythology. And it's sort of this wonder at the unknown in the very close proximity world. And these are, you know, the idea of, if you look at this myth, the sort of mystical creatures from Gaelic mythology, they're all fairies and brownies. There's a lot of horses that live in the sea. They're very mundane, though. Like, they're sort of demonic creatures and more like it's a man with one eye, one arm and one leg. But if you see him before he reaches you, he might give you a penny. They're usually just twists on natural stuff. And it gives me the real feel of back in the past when people genuinely believed these things to the fullest that they can believe them. People didn't know what was going on in a neighboring village. If you think, like, you don't know what your friend did last Saturday, try to work out what your friend did last Saturday when there's no means of communication, save a 3-day walk. And then what's going on in another country? You probably never left your county, you know? And the mythology really reflects that. This feeling of the world is not a place that I know. Why should there not be moon horses that only appear by the light of the moon? I mean, I'll be honest. I kind of put the moon horses in for my girlfriend because she loves horses. And I love horses. I love riding. I always say riding is one of the only... two or three things I can do which turn my brain off. Well, this is a bit of a ramble, isn't it? But I have an inner monologue, a voice in my head that talks to me relentlessly, not stopping. Sometimes, you know, to the point it won't let me sleep. I get on a horse, it goes away. And that's one of my favorite things.
I can see that with even just the experiences of the Moon Horse within the novel, and we won't do any spoilers, but yes, you must read it so that you can learn about the Moon Horses.
Talking about monsters, and this is going to kind of lead into some questions further down here just by the language of it. Do you maintain a monster manual?
I don't, but I probably should. I have a file called info, which I write down things as I come up with them along the way. So I do no world building of any type before I start writing the book. Everything that I come up with is devised as I go along, because it needs to be included to serve the plot, to perform a role. I frequently have to control F through my manuscript and find certain keywords. I'm very fortunate in that when I've turned the book into Tor, my publisher, produce a style sheet where somebody else goes through the whole book and writes down all the proper names I've put in. They write down all the monsters. They write down all the silly terms I've come up with. And they create this whole style sheet for me. And then I refer to that. Yeah, that's really useful. I have, in the past, one of my previous books in the Raven's Mark series, a company called Ander Rider Books did a special edition, and we managed to do a 15-page kind of monster manual at the end with illustrations for all the strange things from those books, which is great. You know, seeing one art form getting, you know, added to with somebody else's art is a really great thing.
Obviously, we've got necromancy here. Do you believe in ghosts?
You know, so I am the ultimate skeptic. Okay, unfortunately, I am a full-on non-believer. In every time I go to Los Angeles, I have arguments with people because they can't help but ask me what my star sign is, and then I have to say I refuse to talk about it, and then they get angry with me because they don't believe in horoscopes. No, I'm an ultra skeptic, and I don't like it when people try and make me accept what they believe. However, my partner and I we had a writing retreat recently. We don't write well in London, so we like to get away and get a lot of words down. And while I was there, I was sleeping. I was on my she had terrible jet lag from coming back from the States, so she was up writing at 3 a.m. But about 1 a.m, I was lying in bed asleep, and I had this plush octopus toy. She's called Tentaclara. And I just felt her land on my arm. And I opened my eyes and looked around. And there she was, bizarrely on my arm, and no one else in the room. And I looked around and I was like, but how? Tentaclara, how did you get here? And I went through and asked my girlfriend, and she freaked out. She was terrified when I went in the room. It was like 1, 2 a.m. She wasn't expecting me to be awake. She was like typing away. I was like, did you throw the octopus at me? Then the wind blew the front door to open on the following night. And we just decided not to talk about the ghost.
My wife and I have very different views on supernatural things. I am in your camp of it's complete skepticism, but I want the experience. If it's there, I'll put myself into those situations. So honeymoons, anniversaries, it's all been like haunted places or horrific places, just kind of seeking out where she has the experiences. And I'm like, okay, but I can explain this kind of stuff. So I feel you on this.
Well, wait until you get a plush octopus toy thrown at you in the middle of a night by a ghost. I tell you what, I'll add one thing to this, which is I've always kind of been a determinist. I find it hard not to see that everything that ever happens and will happen is a chain reaction of chemicals and elements and energy just moving in the directions that it was flung and the forces that are working upon it, which are, you know, physical laws. What I can't get my head around is sentience and the irrationality of some of the feelings that we have, love in particular. And I think that's why it's at the heart of every book I write. I've been branded a grim, dark author in the past, but all my stories are love stories from start to finish. They're about romance, just with a lot of killing and swords along the way. And I think it's the most mystifying thing. I think it causes us to make all the wrong decisions all the time. There's no rational decision that comes from love. It's something everyone craves, but when you have it, it's the worst thing in the world because the terror of losing it then becomes all-consuming to people. So they make marriage into an idea where you get married so someone promises they won't stop loving you, even though you know that's not true. And we just choose to believe it. The irrationality of this feeling and the fact that love could cause somebody to, they haven't done it yet, but one day someone will do a space mission on the back of romantic love to impress someone or to rescue someone or whatever it might be. And the fact that humans could evolve over billions of years to reach a point where we go into, we head to other planets for the sheer irrationality of romantic love is like parental love is really easily explained. Evolutionary biology, you got to keep them alive. You got to like them more than yourself or you will get tired of them. But yeah, romantic love, it seems to defy all rational explanation. So perhaps that's why I enjoy writing it so much.
In the Red Winter Chronicles, the lead character is Rain, and it's all written in first-person perspective. She's a complicated character who can see the dead, but would be shunned if anyone found out. She tries to do good, but there's definitely a blurred gray lines everywhere. How do you stay within a first-person perspective for this complex storyline while being true to Rain, but still allowing your other characters to grow and morph into their own story arcs all around her?
First person perspective is my natural go-to writing method, but it's brilliant for character voice. It's great for being an unreliable narrator. It becomes very difficult when there's offstage action. Your character can't see. There's no way they can see it, but you have to know it. And how do you get that in without information dumping on the reader? Yeah, it can be tricky. There's a few points in Trail of Red Winter. Rather than being labeled as chapters, it says just a dream. Essentially, Rain is dreaming into the memories of the tyrannical witch queens of the past. Or maybe they're her memories. Or maybe they're the Queen of Feathers memories. We'll find out in book three. In the third book, the upcoming book, which is out in November, things get even more complicated because as the narrative gets bigger and bigger to encompass like sort of national or global events, how do you see all that from one character's perspective? Unless they are like, you know, if they're the king or they hold a high-ranking position, that's why we tell those stories, because those are the people who know what's actually going on. I like telling the stories of the people who are more on the front lines. So Rain is not of lofty, well, she's sort of both of this sort of exalted magical position. And at the same time, compared to the other people who are, she's dirt on their shoes. So she doesn't have all the information and it all has to come through other people. In the third book, this gets much more complicated. And I've had to do something narratively, conceptually, a huge jump from anything I've done before, whilst only keeping to her perspective. I'm really looking forward to seeing how readers will... I can't reveal what it is or talk about it because it's a plot element as well as a narrative construct. But really, it's more literary fiction in a way than your typical fantasy book. Or no, more like psychological thriller, let's be honest. Yeah, so I'm excited to see how readers will enjoy that. But if I said that at one part I've been writing in first-person plural present tense injected as parts of the narrative.
That's really complicated.
Yeah, and that this is how you get to tell stories using first-person to spread out dream sequences, visions that they often form a key part of my story elements because I need the character to know what's going on way over there. Oh, and then I look through the mirror. Fortunately, it showed me exactly the right moment in time that I needed.
Kind of building off that, do you enjoy writing the protagonist or the antagonist more?
Well, because I write first person, I'm always writing the protagonist. But I like to write anti-heroes who are actually heroes who just talk about how bad they are. In my first series, The Raven's Mark, the protagonist is called Galharo. Galharo, He talks a big game about how much he'd torture people and what a, you know, what a bad man he is. And he's living on, he's an alcoholic living on the edge. He only does good things. You know, it's all smoke and mirrors. I'm never going to write a scene where a protagonist of mine does any torturing, like, in that way, because I wouldn't like them if they did it. And I have to like them. I have to really love my antagonists in a different way. I think in both the first two Red Winter books, the antagonist would be a spoiler for either. But the character from Traitor of Red Winter is, I feel that they are very believable. I feel that they're very real, and they actually reflect certain views that have developed or come into light in the last maybe 20 years, that we come to recognize that this is how the world works. This is how people are treated. This is the narcissistic, self-consuming belief in oneself. And it's microaggressions that form part of a wider narrative of oppression and inequality, where to some people, other people aren't people. They're commodities. They're things to be used. They're things that they want. And the antagonist from Traitor is really fun to write, because I know, I've met the person. I know exactly what this kind of person is like, and the level of delusion, their refusal to even consider or look at or acknowledge that anything that happens isn't about them. I think for some people, it's not even a case of objectively they can figure it out. It just can't register, because that is their world. So that was a lot of fun to write. But I will say I am very much an enjoyer of cosmic forces of evil. I love an outworldly dark presence that just exists to do harm. Some people say evil's a matter of perspective. I like to think that there are Cthulhu-esque creatures out there who just want to drive us mad with their mouths and eyes.
You mentioned this a little earlier, but the Daughter of Red Winter just kind of transformed so much from its origins in 2012. Can you share a little bit about that book transformation from its early conceptions to the official publication?
Oh, okay. So it started life. It was 280,000 words long, and it was about a male character, and it had no story. It had no plot. It just meandered around. And this is a book that I wrote over a couple of years. No preparation or planning, no idea where it was going, really. To be honest, a lot of it was just about sort of my life at when I'd been at university, but in a fantasy setting, which didn't make for a great story. But I sent it to agents, and agents said, this is too long, can you cut it in half? And I looked for a midpoint, and I thought, no. I looked for an endpoint, and I thought, there isn't really one. It's just sort of, you know, it's part one of seven as well. This is crazy. I took the agent's advice and wrote something shorter. But I came to write Red Winter. I ditched this. I put it in the bin forever, long ago. And then after I finished the Raven's Mark books, I really struggled to re-engage with something to write. I wrote so many false starts, 200,000 words worth of false starts. That's two novels. And I was in France, and I was in a swimming pool. And I thought, why don't I take a look at old stuff? Because my first novel that got published, I'd done that with. I binned it, and then I came back to it a few months later and retried it. So I had a look. And as I did, I started by initially trying to see what I could salvage and rewrite. And as I went along, it just became apparent I had to change everything till not an original word remained. And as I was doing it, I could feel something still wasn't right about it. My partner is Katrina Ward, author of Needless Street and Sundial and Looking Glass Sound. And I said to her, there's something wrong with the character, but I've made so many changes to so many story beginnings where I change them and change them and change them to try and make them work, and then regret the change and undo it the next day. I said, I don't know if I should go ahead with it. I think this character is female. And that was quite a big thing for me. I've never written a female protagonist before. And as a male author, I think you can't help but be very aware of people waiting to criticize you for doing so. There is a lot of online comedy about male authors writing female characters. So you want to get it right. You want to convey a true, you know, a lived experience, a real, you know, I'm no more a 6'10", like muscle bound Hulk than, you know, than I am a teenage girl. So all characters are imagined, but you want to convey it authentically and not make those errors. And so I said to Kat that I think this character is female, and I decided to sit on it for 3 days, at the end of which I thought, but she is. I know who she is. And so I started going through and I made those changes. And once I did that, everything else in the entire book changed because it couldn't be the same story anymore. Suddenly, there's a whole lot of themes in Red Winter Chronicles, which they're more or less during COVID. My partner and I sat in a house together and told each other our stories. And I got a perspective on what it would be like growing up as female. And I don't by any stretch of the imagination mean, oh yeah, now I get it. Now I understand. And sorry if this is going off slightly off track, but what men don't know is there is essentially a secret world that women live in plain view all the time that men aren't party to, because it's the way that men interact with women when other men are not around. Because men don't do this in front of other men, because if they did, they'd feel shame. But they do it in front of women because they don't feel shame, because they're not treating women as equal. And as the more and more we traded these stories, and the more and more I got to see this, it just invaded or flowed into Rain's character. And I think this is part of the reason male authors get a lot of flack for this, is and don't necessarily understand why they're getting flack. It's very, very hard, I think, to convey what it would be like being a young woman, where every interaction that you have with a man is flavored and colored by the fact that you're male and female. Because men don't get this. Men don't have it. We often interact, you know, men consider themselves default. So if you don't know this happens because you don't see it, well, then it's very hard to write it. Anyway, that's how Rain came about. That's and I think her character and this sort of world, this idea of the world, impacts then the magic and the way the magic works, because it has to. They're all one and the same. The magic is there for Rain to be part of her story. So it's trauma and it's the past coming back to haunt and so on.
It was a very believable female protagonist. I enjoyed her character a lot.
I've had feedback from readers in two ways. I've had readers say that to me, and I've also had readers get very angry about her. Sometimes readers feel that they don't like sometimes themes. Very in the opening of Daughter of Redwinter, Rain is 17 and she's in a relationship with a man who is twice her age, or she thinks she's in a relationship with him, and he's effectively groomed her since she was a kid. And some readers get very angry that this is in the book. You're not meant to support it. You're not meant to like it. But these are the terrible decisions that have been made for you or you make when you are a teenager, because you don't know anything. You know, when this lover tells her when she thinks about how he loves her, as a reader, you're meant to know that he doesn't, and you're meant to know that she knows that he doesn't, but she's telling you he does because she has to believe it. So some readers have been a little annoyed. But hey, as long as everyone has an opinion, eh?
One of the things we like to do is we like to play a little game. You might know it as something else, but we call it Kiss, Marry, Ditch here. So I'm going to give you three categories to choose from. Inside that category, there will be three things that you will tell us which one you like, which one you love, and which one we're going to get rid of.
Okay.
So the choices you have to make for the categories to choose from here are, and I've hidden them, they're not straightforward, so you're going to have to kind of go into it a little bit blind. Reach for It, This Sucks, and The Black Cats.
I mean, I think I have to go for The Black Cats.
We're doing a D&D villains here.
Okay.
So we're going to rank. I've got three that are kind of iconic at this stage. Xanathar, Vecna, and Tiamat. Like, love, and hate.
Okay. I mean, love Vecna. I mean, he's just a rotting old dude without an eye and a hand, isn't he? Everyone's got... I love an undead wizard. Absolutely. They're under wizards are at the core of what I do. I like Tiamat. I mean, it's a bit silly. Like all the different colors of dragons all stuck on one dragon. And who's Xanathar was the last one.
Yeah.
Is Xanathar a beholder?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll get in the bin. Yeah. Xanathar can go in the bin. Like, it's a floating eyeball with extra eyes. It's amazing that that's become so iconic, really, isn't it? Like, it's a bit like, what would a child come up with if it was drawing a monster? It's a big eye with a lot of eyes sticking out of it. Amazing.
It's the joys of marketability, right? And I guess Vecna's having his resurgence at the moment. So we got TV shows. We got a potential, I guess, movie. It's 50 years of D&D. So we're getting, you know, his entire multiplanar attack coming out. So I'm with you.
I am a big D&D player. I have hundreds of thousands of words of campaigns written. And I play probably three times a month, 6-hour sessions. Shout out to the Flying Snakes and Pig and the Bone Dogs. They're my parties. Absolutely love it.
So this sucks. We would have made you do some fantasy, some fictional vampires and reach for it. I would have made you rank some Lee Child's books.
Oh, I mean, I do love a Jack Reacher. I love the familiarity of it. I love the fact that I know exactly what's going to happen in every one. There's going to be a woman who's in trouble. Jack Reacher is going to say he wants to leave town, but he doesn't. And then he goes and shoots some dudes.
Yep.
Love it. My girlfriend's mum loves them as well. We always end up talking about like how we bond over our shared love of Reacher Said Nothing.
I'm guessing you have caught both seasons so far.
I have. I love the first season. I thought the second season didn't quite have it as much. But you know what? I'm more than willing to go a few more seasons.
It was one of those things where second to me felt more like it focused too much on the violence of him as opposed to the character. It was just, you know, kind of, whatever.
Well, they've got a difficulty in making Reacher into a series, which is book by book, there are very few recurring characters. A lot of books don't have any. So how do you make a TV show about someone who has no recurring characters? And I think for the TV show, they are going with the theme of Neely and these sort of this old team. I hope they kill them all off in the next series because that's not the point of Jack Reacher. he's a wandering samurai, isn't he? He's the samurai who walks from town to town, being grouchy, getting inadvertently involved in things, shooting everyone.
Well, we were talking gaming, and I'm right there with you. I have been a gamer for a very, very long time here, but you are the forever DM, from what I understand. I was going to ask how that influenced your writing, but I'm, you know, as a gamer, I'm more curious, how does your writing influence your gaming?
It means that I do a hell of a lot of writing and prep around it. I mean, this is the most mundane part of the answer I can give, but basically, if you do a lot of writing, your writing speed increases and the ease with which you generate ideas increases. So a normal writing day, I do about between 2,000 and 5,000 words. I know some people would find this arduous, but I sit down in front of the TV with my laptop and I just make D&D. And that is so relaxing. I love it. It's the most calming thing. Just making up an elf. Just, you know, working out how a trap functions. Just creating a political situation. It does mean, I think, that I always want there and need there to be an overarching storyline. I run narrative-led campaigns where I tell the players at the beginning, your characters are going to this place to do this thing. The reason that you're personally involved, you can come up with your protagonist arc. And I also require them to individually, their player characters have to have a personal, unsolved, magical nature mystery. It doesn't have to be magical. It can be mundane, but it usually ends up being magical. And then they have to leave that with me. And over the course of 2.5 years of real time, you know, one of them discovered that they were Storm God Jesus. They were their own god that they worshipped. One of them discovers the book that they're reading is devouring the souls of the things that they kill. I mean, that sounds quite familiar to Traitor Redwinter, doesn't it? So, yeah, I have major character storyline arcs, but they have to also fit into a greater, wider story structure. So, yeah, one of the things about writing is it's also intuitive when you're doing it. The only time you ever think about these things is in interviews and podcasts where people want to know how it works. And I honestly don't think about any of these things at all. I just sit down and do it. And through the cost of 1.5 million words of unpublished novels, that's my immunity to disease. You know, through the cost of a million lives, I've learned how to do this. And so you just sit and do it.
Is there a chance that we'll see a Red Winter setting, tabletop setting?
I wouldn't do Red Winter because I don't think it has enough difference or variation in sort of the creatures and things you'd encounter there. As a system for a tabletop RPG, the magic system, I think, could actually make a really good leveling up system because it basically works in levels to a high degree. I'd be much more likely to make the Raven's Mark books as a setting because the setting is much weirder. The monsters are stranger. It has more than one, multiple types of magic. So it would have a greater range for players and a greater range for monsters. If anyone's out there running a Kickstarter and they need a setting and they want someone to do 100,000 words very cheap. I'd take a job working in tabletop roleplay games, but of course, those are rare as horse feathers, and the common way of seeing it is that you have to do a lot of unpaid work to get some poorly paid work before you can get anything that's going to pay your bills. But I'd probably just do it for the fun. I have done a little. It hasn't been published yet, so I can't see what it is. But I've done a very small amount, and I was looking at moving to Seattle if I could get a job over at one of the games companies there. I'd happily go. If you're listening.
And how badass is it to sit as a DM behind a DM screen that has been intricately carved to resemble your book covers?
Tor commissioned this as a giveaway. It's amazing. It's a work of beauty. It's absolutely like cut wood. And they made one for a promotional giveaway. And I just said, could I have one? I'll pay for it. And they said, no, we'll send you one as well. So it's one of those things I'd never expected that to happen or for anything like that to ever exist. When I first sold my first book, Blackwing, my editor, Gillian Redfern, said to me, don't spend your advance repairing the boiler or putting it in the mortgage. Buy yourself something of significance. So, you know, so you've got a memento. And I put some of it on, you know, the mundane things. But one thing I did, I commissioned a guy called Marco Donnelly to forge me a sword to my specific specifications with a raven built into the handguard. It was a cross between a 1796 British light cavalry saber and a Scottish backsword with the silver wire hilt. And there's no other sword like it in the world. It's sharp as well. This was not for training with. This was for being a sword. So, you know, you never expect things like that to happen. And it's funny the way that life works out. I was 11 years old and I sat down and I wrote the Phoenix Ruby with my sister, which I think was mostly an excuse to draw pictures of heroes and, wizards and warriors, and then write a story about them. And then all these years later, you know, this is where we are and this is what we're doing.
And so cool that you have more in your family who do creative writing as well. Slight tangent, the audiobook narrator, Samara McLaren, really brought Rain's character full circle. She was wonderful, and I will definitely be listening to book 3 because of her voice. It's amazing. I love the full audiobook experience. So did you have any say in that audiobook process?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Samara McLaren is absolutely amazing. I believe, if I remember this right, I believe she narrated for some other authors at my UK publisher, Gallants. And I was very keen that we had a Scottish narrator or a voice actor doing a convincing Scottish accent. Edinburgh accent is ideally what I wanted. But my American publisher tour, I think they were concerned that American listeners might be put off by a Scottish accent. I've never encountered this in reality, but there's a lot of thought that Americans don't understand regional accents from the UK, which I don't think is true. I think they do, but there's a fear that they don't. So the idea originally was to have all of the book narrated in a sort of English received pronunciation accent, except for the dialogue, which would be in Scottish accent. So Samara was initially given this as the brief because she's an actor. She was going to do it. And it became immediately apparent when they started recording it. They contacted me on the day and said, "This isn't working. We're two pages in. It's mental. It doesn't sound right." So they took the decision to go like with Samara's Scottish accent instead, which I'm so pleased they did. I'm only a quarter Scottish, but there are a lot of references throughout. Actually, they're sort of places or names of things that are based on places. The Black Isle is one. Black Isle is where I think it's 1783, we find my Julia Antoinette Lowe was my furthest back ancestor we can find. She lived on the Black Isle, which is not an island. It's on the east coast of Scotland. And so I made the Black Isle an island because I thought it would be confusing for readers if I didn't explain that it wasn't an island. So yeah, there's lots of nods throughout that. So I was really glad that Samara didn't have to sort of do it in English, which didn't make any sense.
Her voice is just so beautiful. She can talk about, you know, extreme violence and this horror stuff. And it's just like, oh, but it's so nice.
Yeah, she's a magnificent voice actor. I was so happy to have her on board.
And what are you currently reading / watching?
Watching. I've hit some good ones recently. I'm watching House of Ninjas, which is I think you'll find it on Netflix. It's very silly. It's exactly what you think it was about. It's a family of ninjas, which is great. I watched Avatar The Last Airbender, the new live-action version. I thought it was the most fun show I've seen in so long. It skews a little young, but I don't care. I don't mind if they all, like, you know, you never see anyone die. Oh, I suppose some people get set on fire, don't they? No, that's great. What am I reading at the moment? I am reading Andy Weir's Project Hail Mary. I've never read any Andy Weir before. I mean, my gosh, there's a lot of science in Andy Weir books, isn't there? It's more or less, I feel like Andy Weir wanted to explain how he would go about finding a way to another galaxy using life forms as fuel, and then just made a book to talk about it. But it's great. It's really gripping. If I give a couple of shout outs to books that are coming out in 2024, we've got Genevieve De Mover's Foul Days, which is Slavic folklore, and in a walled city, it's really good. And The Silver Promise, that's coming out some point later this year. It's very sort of Scott Lynchy, Lies of Lachlan Mora, mixed with a bit of all your favorite fantasy authors. There's some deliberate homages throughout it, but it also feels very much like its own book. So yeah, give that a look as well.
If you have not checked it out, Resident Alien is my current go-to watch. Space alien comes down, has to integrate into society, but he's a doctor. So,
okay, that sounds great. Yeah,
I think that's Netflix too, isn't it? It's on my list.
Maybe we don't get it over here.
Oh no!
You're missing out though.
I'm going to LA in a month. So,
there you go. It's got Alan Tudyk as your alien. If that helps you any. We'd like to use this question to kind of get a glimpse into the future when you can't tell us anything about the future. What's the strangest thing in your search history?
Oh, God. You know what? So I'll have a look. I'm going to click on it and see. Grime-encrusted salvage? That's pretty weird. That is an item in World of Warcraft that I had to figure out what it did. I'm sure at some point I've had to check up. You know, the classic is body decomposition, isn't it? I was in a cleaning product store the other day, and I saw there was like a stain remover, and it said gets out any amount of blood. And I thought, but how much blood? How can I ask the person who works there, if I had a lot of blood, how much could I get out with this bottle? No, my partner's search history is much worse than mine, because her books are all like, I make up my fantasy violence. Like sometimes I'll look up, I remember looking up how to put a dislocated arm back into a shoulder and watching some videos on it. But her books, like, you know, they're about real criminal people in the real world and doing the worst things imaginable. She goes to bed listening to murder podcasts. I can't listen to them. They freak me the hell out.
I listened to one last night. I was falling asleep, and it was a gruesome family murder in Durham, North Carolina. It was, everyone died. It was awful. But I was like, okay. It lulls me to sleep.
It's strange, isn't it? It's like a comfort thing. It's like doing your safety homework in a way. I can't listen to them. I have to leave the room when they're on, because they freak me out too much. So yeah, I'm much more comfortable making stuff up and imagining it than I ever would be looking up the details. If I feel it would freak me out to look it up, then I won't look it up. I'd rather just not know, I guess.
And we are a library podcast, so how have libraries impacted your life?
So my mother was a school teacher, and she asked the school librarian what books she could recommend for a boy of my age who, when I think I would have been, I wasn't in high school, so I'd have been about 12, I think, what books they had at the school library that I might be into. And I was obsessed with a board game called HeroQuest. And the librarian recommended David Eddings's Belgariad series. And that was really my introduction into all things fantasy, like good written fantasy. Obviously, David Eddings, I don't know, his name does not stand up these days due to his criminal activities. But as a teen boy, I really fell in love with those books. And then, I used my probably every week until I was growing left home. I go to the library, pick up my 2 to 3 doorstopper sized fantasy novels that I'd ordered, and that's how I spent my time. And without a library, there's no way that I could possibly have, you know, I had no money. I couldn't have bought a book. I would have been unable to read without it. And so, yeah, I think we should all be very, very thankful for libraries. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't enjoy the book at the library, and then if you like it, go out and buy a copy, and buy a copy for your friend. I mean, it's not Christmas. It's hard to do Christmas plugs at this point, but if you're preparing early...
And birthday presents. I bought my sister your book for her birthday because I know she's going to love it. So,
well, a book is a lovely present, actually, isn't it? Like, I don't think people give enough books, because if you choose something you think somebody would like, it's actually much more personal than, you know, most presents that you ever get as an adult. Buy my books, guys. Buy my books. But also get them out the library. Keep libraries alive. We need them.
So as we kind of wrap up here, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I suppose I'll just say it's February. No, it's March at the moment, isn't it?
Yep.
This is the bleakest month of the year, I think. I always think March is an absolute misery. Certainly is in this part of the world. If you're an aspiring author out there and you are feeling this month like your writing is not going anywhere, not doing anything, it may just be the time of year. Hunker down. Like, put up your hatches and keep going. You can only lose by stopping.
And you said book 3 comes out when?
Book 3 is out in November in US and UK. Which Queen of Breadwinner? Spoiler.
I'm so excited.
It's my best book. It's by far my most ambitious book. I've never tried anything like this before. I'm really, really excited for people to read it.
I can't wait to read it as well. I'm so excited. This has been such a treat to have you on Unstacked. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been really enjoyable. And, you know, we don't necessarily get to speak to readers or anyone most of the time. So thank you very much for having me today.
Pleasure has been all ours, I assure you.
Thank you so much, Ed, for joining us on Unstacked. Daughter of Red Winter and Traitor of Red Winter are available in the library collection for checkout.
You can also purchase them through your favorite bookstore and online vendor. Check out his website, edmcdonaldwriting.com, edmcdonaldwriting.com.
Stay safe and read, my friend. It's good for you. Bye.
Bye.